From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Kate Smith. More than 1,200 soldiers from the Minnesota National Guard's 34th Infantry Division, known as the Red Bulls, returned home recently from tours in Iraq. This hour, we bring you highlights from a special NPR series called The Red Bulls Beyond Deployment. We start with Mark Sedeklik, who tells us how Minnesota's National Guard has been transformed from weekend warriors to a combat-tested military force.
My name is Sergeant Roger Boyd. I'm currently located at Camp Basra, Iraq, which is in southern Iraq.
That was Roger Boyd about a week and a half ago via telephone. Boyd got home to southern Minnesota over the weekend. He was looking forward to the reunion with his family.
I really miss my wife and kids.
Boyd deployed for Iraq a year ago. This latest tour was Boyd's second Iraq deployment. More than one in four of the Red Bulls has been deployed to combat before. Nearly two dozen have been through four tours of duty. There are just over 14,000 soldiers and airmen in the Minnesota National Guard. Unlike Boyd, who's African American, most Minnesota Guard members are white, 92%. Most are men, 85%, and their average age is 28. For a long time, Guard service almost exclusively involved training drills, along with natural disaster assistance, and sometimes foreign peacekeeping and humanitarian missions. That all changed on September 11th.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended.
The Minnesota Guard was first drawn into the war on terror within hours of the 9/11 attacks. Fighter jets from Duluth were dispatched to guard airspace over Washington, D.C. Guard officials say since 9/11, there have been more than 19,000 combat deployments from Minnesota, many of them repeat deployments. In 2003, the first Minnesota Guard soldiers were sent to Iraq.
Back then, we didn't get any notice at all.
Dan Henry, who lives near Little Falls, was part of one of those early deployments.
I came home from work one evening and got a phone call at 4 o'clock in the evening and was required to report to camp probably the next morning.
After several days at Camp Ripley in central Minnesota and training at a post in Colorado, Henry was on his way to Iraq. He was 49 years old. When Henry's unit got to Iraq in May of 2003, he says the U.S. military was not nearly as established as it is now.
We didn't have places to sleep. There was no electricity, no running water, that type of thing. So we had to kind of fend for ourselves.
Henry says it was also challenging to come home 6 years ago and fit back into his family life.
I was a first sergeant in our unit. And about 6 months after I got back, my wife stated to me, she says, "You're not the first sergeant of this family."
Dan Henry is glad all of the Guard troops that deployed with him made it back safely. In the years following, many other units would not return intact. The first deaths for the Minnesota National Guard in Iraq came in February of 2005.
There's been no official word yet from the Defense Department or National Guard, but relatives say three Minnesota soldiers died in Iraq on Monday.
The Army said a roadside bomb took the lives of David Day, 25, along with Jesse Latka and Jason Timmerman, both 24 years old. The three were part of a Montevideo-based unit. So far, war on terror combat has taken the lives of 14 members of the Minnesota National Guard. According to the National Guard Bureau, 157 have been injured.
Get on it.
Many people joined the National Guard to help cover the increasing cost of college. That was a big reason Cody Messner enlisted in early 2004.
Hey, did you get that? Gunner's name, Messner.
In 2005, Messner found himself at a military post in Mississippi getting ready to deploy to Iraq. Messner was learning how to fire a mounted machine gun.
Good job. There you go. Good.
At the time, 20-year-old Messner from the southern Minnesota town of Winthrop acknowledged apprehension about going to Iraq, but he said he was ready.
I am looking forward to going there and more of getting it done with and going through with everything. You don't want to wait around for something. You want to go there and get it done.
Messner and roughly 2,500 other Minnesota Guard troops were part of the Guard's first brigade combat team. Their deployment would be the Minnesota Guard's largest since World War II. The soldiers ended up staying in Iraq several months longer than they expected because of the troop surge. when they finally got back in the summer of 2007, they had the distinction of spending more time on the ground in Iraq than any other military unit.
Welcome home, Red Bulls.
At the time, their commander, Major General Rick Erlandson, noted controversy over the war in Iraq, but told the Guard troops to be proud of their deployment.
No matter what history says about Operation Iraqi Freedom, you have given the Iraqi people an opportunity for a better life.
After Iraq, Messner used Guard money to get training as a diesel mechanic. He's still a member of the Minnesota Guard. He's been promoted, and he landed a full-time National Guard job servicing military vehicles at Camp Ripley near Little Falls.
Right now I'm working on this M981.
Messner says coming home was a big shock, but that his reintegration went well. Just a month and a half after returning from Iraq, Messner was in school. He thinks it was a good idea to start school right away. He also said it helped to be around someone else who had also been to Iraq.
It was a big change, you know, going back to college. I mean, because you've been out of high school for a couple of years. But I was able to go to school with one other guy that I was deployed with. We were able to relate to each other and, you know, made it a little bit easier. We work with each other.
Messner says joining the National Guard was the right decision for him. He served for 6 years and re-upped for another year. Right now, he's not sure how long he'll stay in the military. The focus of the war on terror has shifted from Iraq to Afghanistan. It's the place where the most recent Minnesota National Guard combat death occurred. Last October, 24-year-old George Colley of Walker, Minnesota, died following a roadside bomb explosion there. The commander of the Minnesota National Guard, Adjutant General Larry Shelito, calls Afghanistan a very dangerous place, and he says more Minnesota Guard troops will be heading there.
It'll be relatively significant in size. We anticipate they'll be working into key sectors in Afghanistan.
So far, there have been few specifics about the role the Minnesota National Guard will play in Afghanistan. All that's official is that 12 Guard soldiers will head there this spring to train Afghan troops. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
We're continuing with highlights from our series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment. Ambar Espinoza introduces us to the Howe family from central Minnesota to find that homecomings can be bittersweet.
For the past few months, Sherry Howe's five-bedroom house in rural Rockville has been nearly empty. Her husband, Jeff Howe, has been deployed in Iraq for nearly a year, and her two oldest sons are also doing military service. One of them will get deployed to Afghanistan in March, shortly after Jeff comes home later this month.
And then there's a good chance down the road that the older one will be gone too. So a lot of changes in the next year, year and a half.
Sherry admits she's nervous about those changes, including changes she'll see in her husband, because she remembers what that first homecoming was like.
When he came back, he had a shake from the end of his fingers to his elbow, that his arm shook. That was a good couple months, and then he cried a lot.
During his first deployment, Jeff Howe was a commander of a transportation company of 250 soldiers. His soldiers were responsible for moving equipment up and down roads, and they came in contact with lots of improvised explosive devices. 14 of his soldiers were wounded, and one was killed. Someone advised Sherry not to give Jeff the impression that she knew what he was going through.
And I said, I can't even pretend to know what he's going through because he doesn't know what I went through. And that person was kind of amazed because they had never thought of it on our end of it, you know, that we're back here.
On this night, Sherry's home is not so empty. She's cooking dinner for her 19-year-old daughter, Melanie, who's home from college, and her youngest son, 14-year-old Mitchell. Sherry says each member of the family has dealt with the deployments differently, but the overall experience has been filled with pride, sadness, anxiety, and feelings of isolation. Melanie and Mitchell run an errand together in the car, and Mitchell explains how his dad's absence affects him.
When I'm high stress, I tend to fall behind in school. I don't know, it's just something I go through. I just am at a point of don't care.
Those stressful moments weigh heavy with thoughts about his dad's safety. As of last month, there have been at least 4,300 military casualties in Iraq since the start of the war. Three of those have taken place within Minnesota's Red Bull division during Jeff Howe's current deployment. So the worries are very real. Mitchell was in the second grade when his dad told him he was going to Iraq for the first time.
When I was that age, my dad was probably my best friend. And it was really, really hard on me. Like, just going from always having him there to not having him there at all.
His sister Melanie tears up and extends her arm across to comfort her brother.
Just was really hard.
Experts say these emotions are quite normal when children are separated from their parents, regardless of the circumstances.
When you add on top of that, that the reason that their parent is not there is because they are in what the kid knows is a dangerous, potentially dangerous situation.
That's Sonia Batten.
That can add a significant burden for the children.
Batten's a clinical psychologist and the deputy director of a government agency that's designed to help soldiers and their families recover from psychological and brain injuries. She says it's important to let children know these feelings are normal and remind them that their parent is with a trained unit doing everything possible to stay safe. The emotions Mitchell and Melanie Howe feel while their father's in Iraq makes it hard for them to talk to him often. But they've worked to keep him involved during important family events. Last year, the National Guard and Melanie's high school jumped through hoops to arrange a live video chat through Skype so Jeff could see Melanie's high school graduation ceremony, but this ended up leaving Melanie sad.
And it just kind of frustrated me more. It's like, yeah, I can see you and I can talk to you, but you can't, like, hug him or anything like that. That was, like, the only thing frustrating. But other than that, it was kind of cool to see him, but...
She likes to keep conversations with her dad short.
I mean, it's probably not, like, the nicest thing to do to him, but it's just, I don't know, in a way, I kind of am just a little selfish and I'd rather just have it to be so I'm okay.
From his base in Basra through Skype a few weeks ago, Major Jeff Howe says this is all news to him. He thought Mitchell and Melanie simply didn't like using Skype. Jeff says he and Sherry communicate often and have not set up any rules about what they will or will not talk about. Everything is fair game.
When the conversation gets to a certain point, you just say, I don't think we better talk right now, and I'll call you back tomorrow, and let things cool off and let cooler heads prevail.
Jeff says some of those tough conversations include times when Sherry has vented, mainly about people who don't understand their deployment experience. He says soldiers often get thanked for their service, but families don't get enough credit for their sacrifices.
I can't say enough what the families go through and the struggles that they go through to give us the opportunity to do this, because they don't sign on the dotted line. We did.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have higher deployment rates of National Guard and Reserve service members than any other conflicts in history. Experts say Guard and Reserve families don't get the same kind of support available to families living on military bases. Sherry House says people often assume that multiple deployments get easier for the family at home, but they don't. Each deployment brings new changes for the soldier and family.
The kids change, your reactions are different. And the fears are kind of a little different as far as when they come back or even when they're gone. It's kind of that unknown.
Jeff Howe says he also doesn't know what he'll experience during his second homecoming. He gets back just as one of his sons prepares for deployment. For both Jeff and Sherry Howe, the memories of his first return home are still fresh, the shakes and the tears. Jeff suspects he'll handle things better this time, but admits that's what he thought last time.
Things pop into your head, and I cry at a drop of a hat. I'm struggling now, but it's that's the part that really bothered me. It was really very, very frustrating not to be able to control your own emotions when you control everything around you.
These deployment experiences have strengthened the house both as a family and individuals. Sherry House says while it's difficult, it's certainly possible for marriages to survive. Mitchell says he's matured a lot and feels strong enough emotionally to support his dad during his reintegration. In college, Melanie is excited to start a support group for students who come from military families. Jeff Howe is eager to spend time with his family, though he knows a transition home won't be easy. It'll be a while before his family gets a break from deployments. Ambar Espinosa, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rockville.
You're listening to highlights from our series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment, looking at the challenges National Guard soldiers and their families face when they come home from Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Kate Smith. The internet means that for the first time in history, families can enjoy instant communication when someone's deployed. But it also means navigating a minefield of decisions about what to share and what not to. Reporter Jess Mador gives us a glimpse into how technology changes the way military families communicate.
Laurie Kimball is in her usual spot, standing at the kitchen counter in front of her laptop. Her screen is open to Facebook. That's where her daughter, Melissa Kimball, has posted pictures of her room in Basra, Iraq. Laurie reads one of the captions.
Welcome to my room. So they have tents and blankets, sheets and things strung up so they have a little privacy inside the tent. So this is her kind of area.
Laurie's daughter, Melissa, is 19 and on her first deployment with the Minnesota National Guard. With the 9-hour time difference to Iraq, it's sometimes hard for them to keep in touch, but they find a way. In fluent web speak, Laurie Kimball explains how.
Facebook, and then she's got Gmail email. And so a couple times we've been able to chat on Gmail. Because I said post to Facebook, it goes right to my phone. So Friday at 4:01, she posted, Mom, I'm up. Can you Skype right now?
Long-distance electronic communications keep the Kimballs as close as technology can, but it doesn't compare to the real thing. Just after the holidays, Melissa came back to Blaine for a 2-week leave. While she was home, she explained how she uses her laptop in Iraq to keep family and friends updated.
Facebook, pretty much every day. It's an easy way to get up pictures and put up what's going on. It's nice.
The internet offers a whole new world of ways to stay in touch today, but the old rule still applies. Loose lips sink ships. Service members are allowed to communicate with loved ones back home pretty much however they want. Military bases offer free computers with internet, and soldiers can pay extra for private internet access in their bunks. But there are limits. The military trains service members and their families on how to communicate without giving away details that could put people in danger. If they do, service members risk punishment, and blog or Facebook posts can be shut down, though officials say that doesn't happen often. All the instant communication is great, but it also has a flip side. Service members can be at risk when their attention is divided between the mission at hand and what they're missing at home. And families get used to talking a lot, so when their loved ones can't call home, they say they fear the worst. That worry intensifies when there's an attack or a death in a unit. When that happens, there's a communication blackout, which can last hours or days. At her kids' elementary school in Rogers, Peggy Pareda says she first heard about Skype through a friend with a loved one in the military. Skype is a service that lets you call, video chat, and instant message over the internet for free. Now, Pareda uses it all the time to talk to her husband, National Guard Captain Jim Pareda, over webcam.
And it's super easy to set up. When we did Christmas with his family, I just set it on the side table, and he watched the kids open all their Christmas presents and stuff, so kind of made him feel like he was there a little bit, which was really nice. And the kids came over and showed him, you know, each present they opened and stuff like that.
Today, Pareda's 3 school-age children have invited their classmates to video Skype with their dad in Iraq. 8-year-old Charlie's third-grade class goes first.
Hi, everyone.
Captain Pareda greets the kids as they take their seats on the carpet in front of the computer. The image of Jim's face is shaky at times, and there's a few-second delay, but aside from that, the communication's virtually instant. The kids take turns asking a long list of questions they prepared in advance. They ask Pareda what the temperature is in Iraq. He says it's about 75. The time? After midnight. They ask him whether he celebrated Christmas and what he does for fun. The kids laugh when Pareda tells them he's wearing his pajamas. The Paredas have 3 kids at this school. Before he left for Iraq, Captain Jim Pareda visited in person and brought in his uniform and equipment for show and tell. Some of the kids still remember that visit, especially his smelly helmet. They love it when Pareda tells them he has a new, unsmelly helmet now. They make plans for another visit when he gets home. After about an hour of questions with his kids' 3 classes, it's time to say goodbye.
I love you guys.
Everybody tell Daddy goodbye.
Bye, Dada. Bye, Dada.
It's not clear exactly how many military families are keeping in touch over the internet, but lots of them are doing it. In between Skype sessions, Captain Jim Pareda says more than half the soldiers in his unit talk to their families using webcams. He says communicating this way is a lot easier for his young kids to understand than a regular phone conversation can be.
Talking to the kids at home on Skype is really good. I think it gets their interest a little more sometimes than just on the phone.
Peggy Pareda agrees. It's been important for the whole family, she says, especially the children.
I can't imagine them not seeing him for a year, you know, and for him as well, especially with my younger one who's just almost four. You know, obviously they changed so much in a year.
Captain Jim Pareda's deployment is almost up. He's expected back in Minnesota sometime this month. The days of waiting weeks or months for news about a loved one fighting overseas are clearly behind us. But what isn't clear is how all this instant communication may be affecting service members on deployment. Few would say keeping in touch is a bad thing, but there is evidence that worrying about problems back home while in combat can be bad for a service member's health. In fact, University of Minnesota psychologist Michael Miller says that kind of stress makes people more susceptible to mental health problems.
You look at a lot of soldiers who struggle in country, and frequently there are specific or significant events that are happening in their personal life that they don't have any control over. And that frequently leads to making them more susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder.
In addition to counseling people with PTSD, Miller also served 22 years in the military. He helped train commanders and soldiers on how to manage combat stress. He says any added stress, whether it's about family, finances, or anything else, makes service members more susceptible to mental and physical health problems down the road. Jamie Schmitz and her husband, Captain Benjamin Schmitz, who's serving in Iraq, talk almost every day over email, cell phone, and webcam. But they leave a lot out. On her lunch hour in the St. Paul Skyway, Jamie explains how they decided which topics were off limits.
We just decided not to talk about that before he left. Like any major catastrophe at the house, I can tell him about it after I have it handled, but beforehand, yeah, I don't want him to have to worry about that kind of stuff. They don't need to hear those problems.
Nothing major broke down at the house since her husband deployed, but their son, Harrison, was sick a lot. Eventually, he had surgery to remove his tonsils and adenoids and to insert ear tubes. Schmitz's mom helped her take care of her son, but Jamie says it was hard to go through all that without her husband around.
That recovery period was probably the worst 2 weeks of my life. It was very painful for Harrison, and he wouldn't take his medicine. And so I censored it some. I mean, he knew that the surgery was happening. I couldn't not tell him that. I kind of censored how bad those 2 weeks were while he was recovering. It wasn't fun.
Schmidt suspects her husband is doing the same thing, censoring himself to keep her from worrying too much about his safety. She can't wait till he's home so they can both relax. Jess Mador, Minnesota Public Radio News.
You're listening to highlights from our week-long series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment, a look at the challenges National Guard soldiers and their families face when they come home from war. One issue some soldiers encounter is post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. It's estimated about 20% of the veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will suffer from PTSD, depression, or a combination of mental health symptoms. In Minnesota, that means thousands of veterans will experience some trouble. Treating these soldiers has been a challenge for the military. Reporter Jess Mador explains the causes of PTSD and how science may soon be able to help.
A door at the Invergrove Heights Armory opens, and 55 soldiers march in, home from a year in Iraq. The crowd cheers as they line up in formation. Seconds later, they're dismissed. Looking happy and slightly dazed, soldier Jeremiah Hokeness says it's great to be home.
It's kind of a relief. This is my second deployment, so I'm kind of used to it.
The soldiers make their way to a line of overstuffed camouflage bags. For the last time, they heave the giant bags onto their shoulders and go off into the night. For many of them, the road ahead won't be easy. More than 1.6 million U.S. troops have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since October 2001. The Minnesota National Guard reports there have been 19,000 deployments. That number includes people who've done multiple tours. The Department of Defense estimates that up to 20% of those who've served will suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is a condition that can develop after a traumatic event like combat, sexual assault, child abuse, or an accident. While some of the symptoms of PTSD are considered part of a normal reaction to trauma, someone with PTSD experiences a very specific group of symptoms that generally don't fade. They relive the traumatic event and experience the same fear and horror they did at the time of the trauma. They have severe nightmares and flashbacks. Someone with PTSD does everything possible to avoid situations that remind them of the trauma. They feel numb or emotionally distant and hypervigilant, angry, always on guard, and unable to sleep or relax. University of Minnesota psychologist Michael Miller specializes in treating people with PTSD. He also served 22 years in the military. He helped train commanders and soldiers how to manage combat stress. He says loud noises like a car backfiring or fireworks can set off a PTSD reaction. Driving in traffic is particularly scary. In Iraq, bombs are often hidden inside trash or other objects on the roadside. Overpasses offer cover for insurgents to ambush American convoys.
It's not uncommon for people to do everything they can to avoid being on the freeway, places that remind them of Iraq.
A major study by the RAND Corporation, a study which the federal government and the military uses, found the single best predictor for PTSD and depression is exposure to combat trauma on deployment. Past trauma may also play a role. Other studies have shown that high levels of anxiety before deployment and the type of training, support, and preparation a soldier has can also predict the likelihood of PTSD. Veteran Robert Thames sits on a leather sofa in a group home for homeless veterans in Minneapolis. He lost 30 years and two marriages before he was ready to seek help for his PTSD. Thames served in Vietnam as a Navy deck seaman and gunner's mate. It was his job to clear the shoreline of enemy troops so the Marines could land. He knew something was wrong after he got home and pulled a gun on his wife in the middle of the night.
And I'd be in a dead sleep, and I would jump. I would be so startled that I'd grab my gun. Matter of fact, that was really the demise of our marriage, because she couldn't handle it. And I didn't see it. I couldn't recognize what it was, you know.
Thames and his Vietnam buddies tried to help each other because no other help was available. He drank to numb himself, but his symptoms only returned. He had flashbacks and horrible nightmares. With counseling, Thames' PTSD is under control for the first time since he got back from Vietnam in 1975. He's glad to see the government is now trying to help returning veterans so they don't have to suffer what he went through.
They recognize what they did wrong in Vietnam, and now they're trying to rectify that and make sure they don't make that same mistake with these young vets that's coming from the Gulf, and kind of proud of them doing that.
Sergeant Hopper saw lots of casualties, IEDs, and when he came back, he was a different man.
This video is part of the Defense Department's new strategy to reduce stigma around mental health. Many say the military is addressing mental health issues head-on for the first time. There's a new federal agency designed to study the psychological effects of war and create programs to treat traumatic brain injury and PTSD. Navy Captain and Dr. Edward Simmer is in charge.
Military leaders at the very highest levels of the chain of command are very engaged and very interested in this issue.
The military has taken concrete steps to encourage veterans with PTSD to seek help. Mental health records related to PTSD are no longer required when service members apply for a security clearance. And in most cases, the military doesn't share medical records with promotion boards to prevent job discrimination against people with PTSD. Historically, simply diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder was a subjective process. But disagreements over whether someone has PTSD may soon be a thing of the past. At the Brain Sciences Center at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center, Dr. Apostolos Georgopoulos, who goes by the nickname Dr. G, shows off a MEG machine.
Close the door, you look ahead, and that's it. No magnets, you don't lose your credit cards.
MEG stands for magnetoencephalography. Dr. G and his colleagues used the MEG for their research, and what they found was breathtaking. For the first time, they identified a distinctive brain pattern for PTSD in more than 97% of the subjects. The MEG sensors take a series of overlapping images of the brain. The images give doctors a detailed picture of the neural activity and communication patterns in the brain's cerebral cortex. The scans are painless and take just 1 minute to complete.
Dr. G says the discovery proves once and for all that PTSD is a brain disease.
These recurrent experiences, these memories that haunt you and they come back and back and back and you relive these disasters to the extent that you cannot do anything else, you're incapacitated. They create a brain pattern that we can identify.
Dr. G says we could soon see a day when all service members have their brain scanned before deployment and after they get home. The identification of a distinct brain pattern gives legitimacy to generations of soldiers with PTSD who've been fighting for recognition. It's a breakthrough, but science only goes so far. The burden is still on service members to ask for help. University of Minnesota psychologist Michael Miller says military culture makes asking for help risky.
The last thing you want to do is show any vulnerability. That's not acceptable, not when you have to rely on the person next to you to keep you alive.
Many fear seeking help could hurt their military careers. The numbers bear this out. A recent national study found that only about half of service members with PTSD or depression have sought treatment. And of those who did, only about half got adequate care. Jess Mador, Minnesota Public Radio News.
In a moment, more highlights from the Red Bulls Beyond Deployment. From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Kate Smith. About 1,200 soldiers from the Minnesota National Guard's 34th Infantry Division, the Red Bull Brigades, are home after nearly a year deployed in Iraq. Today, highlights from our series, The Red Bulls Beyond Deployment. Tom Robertson talked with veterans in rural Minnesota to bring us a story about the obstacles they face accessing mental health services. Some must travel to cities and towns hours from home to get the medical care they need.
Greg Roberts and his girlfriend Lila are relaxing in their living room. Roberts considers spending time playing with their dogs a sort of therapy.
Dance? Good boy.
The former National Guard staff sergeant would never have guessed he'd need therapy. Roberts figured after coming home from 16 months in Iraq, the adjustment would take maybe a month or two.
It's something I did not anticipate is coming home and having it be a more difficult experience than actually being deployed. Like, I was pretty much emotionally dead.
Roberts is 32 years old. He was in charge of a team of infantry soldiers who carried out combat patrols west of Fallujah. At the time, it was one of the most dangerous regions in Iraq. Often their job was to find and disable improvised explosive devices on hot desert highways. Roberts says life in Iraq meant always being on high alert.
You get that constant stress every day, 24 hours a day, for so long that becomes normal, that you're always amped up, you're always stressing. That changes you.
The most horrific moment of the war for Roberts came late afternoon on March 23rd, 2007. He and another team member, Specialist Eric Algers, responded to a roadside explosion that included U.S. casualties. When they got to the site, they found the bomb had killed a friend from their own company, Staff Sergeant Greg Weaver, a Frazee.
To see a guy that I'd known for years, and it was just the nicest guy, and then all of a sudden, bam, there he is, he's dead, and you're staring at him on the road, and that's when you really have to face your own mortality.
Specialist Eric Alger recalls they could see smoke as they approached the site.
We pulled up and the truck was overturned. You know, guys laying all over, other guys running around helping. I saw this, it just looked like, you know, some body armor and whatnot. And then once we had figured out that that was Greg, you know, my, that's when it really hit you, you know. You know, knees started to buckle, and that was tough.
Rewer's death was hard on everyone, but things got worse. As part of President George Bush's surge in Iraq, Alpha Company's deployment was extended by 4 months. The extension was psychologically devastating to the unit's morale. Finally, in July 2007, Alpha Company returned home to Bemidji. There were people in the streets waving flags. Eric Alger says the festive scene felt surreal after coming from a combat zone. Once the welcome was over, the soldiers went their separate ways to find a way back to a normal life. Alger says many of them did it alone.
Once everyone gets home, they turn into cockroaches, you know, just everyone scrambles. And I'm not going to lie, it was tough to adjust back. I mean, you can't just throw someone back into the real world. It was tough to adjust, and I think I've done pretty well.
For some of the soldiers, things got tougher with each passing month. Greg Roberts felt depressed. He was restless and irritable. Moments of normal stress made him shut down or react with anger. Loud noises triggered panic.
I found that I didn't really care for crowded places, like going to a crowded restaurant, a crowded store. I didn't like it because I didn't know what was going on. There's too much going on. Yeah, I still don't.
It was 6 months before Roberts realized he had post-traumatic stress disorder. Along the way, he got support from his girlfriend, Lila Owens, a native of North Carolina. Owens is a veteran of the Iraq War, too. She's also dealing with PTSD. The two met when they were both on R&R at a resort in Qatar. Owens says living with Roberts has helped them fight their demons together. She recalls the moment she realized a relationship with Roberts would be challenging. They were riding in a car together on a Bemidji highway. Roberts got angry when a car behind them was following too close.
He stops the car in the middle of traffic, gets out of the car, walks to the guy and tells him to get off my effing rear, and then gets back in the car and drives, and that's that. And I'm sitting here going, okay, we can work through this. We can do this.
It was a full year and a half before Greg Roberts went to the Veterans Administration for help. He says he had an emotional breakdown. He'd been having 3 or 4 panic attacks a week. Lila took him to the emergency room several times because of the burning sensation in his chest.
Couldn't breathe, sweating, classic stress responses. Very, very uncomfortable. Probably the worst thing I've ever experienced. And it just came out of nowhere. Just smacked me like a 40-ton grain truck.
All the while Roberts was back home, he'd wanted nothing to do with his fellow soldiers. He didn't like thinking about the war, and seeing them was too much of a reminder. As time passed, he found out that other soldiers were struggling too. Some had family troubles. Some got DWIs. One friend lost his job over an anger outburst. Last September, the members of Alpha Company got word that one of their own had taken his own life. Roberts says news of the suicide spread quickly, and it drew most of them together for the first time in 2 years.
The day he committed suicide, you know, and the phone started ringing, everybody called everybody else, and some of us ended up at the armory. And we sat around kind of shocked that he had done it, but once we started talking and everybody put their little piece of the puzzle together, it was so obvious what he was going to do. It was staring at us in the face.
The tragedy was a wake-up call for Alpha Company. Some in the unit vowed to keep closer tabs on each other. Even so, many drifted apart once again since the incident last fall. Greg Roberts says he knows some of his fellow soldiers are still hurting, but they're either afraid of the stigma or are too proud to ask for help.
And I know one guy that has anxiety attacks, and it's obviously PTSD related, because it's the exact same thing I went through, that he said he doesn't want to be a leech on the system, or he doesn't. You know, he feels somehow honor-bound to just suck it up.
Robert says he's making progress with his own mental health. He got weekly therapy from the VA for a few months. He's on several medications. He still checks in with a psychiatrist. Members of Alpha Company had different experiences with the VA. Eric Alger didn't need much help, but got what he asked for. Greg Roberts applied for and receives disability compensation from the agency. But Roberts is still frustrated. He wanted someone to reach out to him, but the help he received came because of his own efforts.
It's almost like a social band-aid in a way. They just started sending me a check. And I'm like, hey, you know what? That's great and everything. I'd rather be normal again. You know, I thought maybe somebody would call me, try to set up a counseling session. No, you have to be proactive about it.
Since Roberts returned home, the VA created a new program that makes contact with every returning soldier. After floundering for 2.5 years, Greg Roberts says he's ready to move forward with his life. Before his deployment to Iraq, he was working on a master's degree in mental health counseling. But Roberts has given up on that idea. He's now taking classes to become a chiropractor. Tom Robertson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Bemidji.
You're listening to highlights from our series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment. The challenges National Guard soldiers and their families face when they return to civilian life. In Bemidji, the recent homecomings bring back memories for some Red Bull veterans. For Bemidji's Alpha Company, the memories of war are still fresh. Reporter Tom Robertson tells us they're struggling to reclaim their civilian lives.
If you're a veteran in International Falls and you need mental health counseling from the VA, you'll have to drive 100 miles to the nearest VA therapist in Hibbing. If you need a face-to-face visit with a psychiatrist, you may have to travel all the way to St. Cloud or the Twin Cities.
It's just the distance and the fact that we're so small. We just fall off the radar screen.
That's Dr. Jeff Hardwick. He's the only psychiatrist in International Falls. For years, the Veterans Administration contracted with him to provide some mental health services to veterans. The VA ended its contract with Hardwick nearly 2 years ago.
We want to be of assistance to our veterans. We want to help them. And they come here because they want to get some help, and they want to get some help close to home. And so, that's a frustrating situation.
Private healthcare providers across the state share that frustration. It's part of a shift in strategy for the Veterans Administration. Rather than contracting with private providers, the VA wants to offer the service itself, even if it means a longer drive for veterans. Robert Hamilton is a staff sergeant with the Minnesota National Guard. He lives in the small town of Chisholm on the Iron Range. Hamilton suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder as well as physical injuries he suffered during deployments in Iraq in 2005 and Afghanistan last year. Hamilton considers himself lucky he's able to get mental health therapy at a VA clinic in nearby Hibbing. But the clinic can't meet all of Hamilton's health issues, especially the care he needs for neck and back injuries.
There's really not much they can do for me. Anything more than just an office visit requires me to go to Minneapolis, which is about three and a half hours away. And then the 3.5 hour drive back, so it pretty much kills the whole day.
The drive for Hamilton could be a lot shorter if the VA allowed him to get health care closer to home. But contracting with private providers was expensive for the agency. That's according to Tammy Jedlicka, a clinical social worker with the VA.
With budget cuts and the large number of veterans being served, they can't afford to do that anymore. And so one of the things they're doing is trying to provide more services in the communities.
More VA services in communities means more clinics. Since the 1990s, the VA has moved away from hospital-based care. There are now nearly 800 community-based outreach clinics in the U.S. There are 9 in Minnesota. One of the newest opened in 2007 in Bemidji. That's where Tammy Jedlicka works as a mental health therapist. She says one of the clinic's big advantages is that it offers telemedicine services. That means veterans can talk to psychiatrists or psychologists over a video connection instead of driving hours to their nearest VA hospital. Veterans can get mental health therapy at the Bemidji VA clinic, but Jedlicka says the resource is limited.
I am the only one here, and right now I'm scheduling out about 6 weeks to see people because it's that busy. We have a pretty high caseload.
Veterans returning from Iraq or Afghanistan these days will find a far different Veterans Administration than the era of the last major conflict in Vietnam. Back then, the expectation for veterans was that you fought, you came home, and maybe you got a monthly disability check. VA officials say their mission now includes far more outreach. Heidi Sanger is a VA veterans case manager based in Grand Forks, North Dakota. She works for a program that's only 3 years old. It focuses solely on veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Sanger says the VA's efforts to reach rural veterans are evolving but steadily improving.
Times have changed. We've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about how to provide resources to veterans.
One of the biggest changes is outreach. Sanger's job is to talk with veterans by phone or in person.
We're actually contacting every one of the veterans. Initially, we would do follow-up with ones we were more concerned about. But we've changed to making sure we have contact with every single one.
In those conversations, Sanger asks service members how they're doing. She connects them with mental health or other services they might need. Some say even more outreach is needed for veterans, especially in rural areas. Dustin Osten is a veterans case manager for St. Louis County in Duluth. Osten says many returning vets have trouble adjusting to civilian life, but they're often reluctant to admit they have a problem and typically don't ask for help.
Tracking these guys down and getting them to seek services is like pulling teeth. Even though the military has taken great steps in trying to say it's okay to seek services, there's still that underlying military mindset that you're considered weak if you seek services.
Osten says he believes the further veterans live away from mental health services, the less likely they are to address their issues. Reliable transportation is a problem for some, and Osten says hours of travel time getting to a counselor means time away from work and other obligations.
A lot of them are going to school full-time, and to drive and not go to school, they have to make a choice. And sometimes they'll make the choice to go to school rather than seeking out services.
The VA is working on new programs to bridge the gap for rural veterans. Captain Edward Simmer is Director of Psychological Health at the Defense Centers of Excellence in Washington, D.C. Simmer says the agency is looking for ways to use technology to reach veterans.
One of the things we now have is online counseling. If you have a computer with an internet connection and a webcam, you can set up counseling use across the web from the comfort of your own home. And we're very excited about that.
VA outreach also includes bringing services directly to the places that need them. In the fall of 2008, the VA put the first fleet of 50 mobile counseling centers into service. The units resemble a recreational vehicle from the outside. Captain Simmer says they're equipped to offer mental health services.
People can go there and anonymously talk to a counselor in a private place. And that makes, again, help much more accessible because, you know, the greatest help in the world is only useful if people can get to it.
The mobile program is a work in progress. Minnesota has only one of the vehicles. It's been in the state for about a year, but isn't fully staffed yet. And it's based not in rural Minnesota, but in the Twin Cities. Program officials say they hope to eventually schedule regular visits to see veterans in small rural towns. Tom Robertson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Bemidji.
We continue with highlights from our series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment. In the coming weeks, many members of the Red Bull Brigades will return to civilian jobs. Many will change their career path. About a third of the troops will be unemployed, and some will find they just can't go back to work. Dan Gunderson talked with people who've already made the transition from citizen soldier to civilian.
Winter is the quiet season at Grandview Resort on Leech Lake. But Jeff Anderson is busy preparing for what he hopes will be a busy summer.
There is a never-ending list of stuff to do.
There's a military theme among the log buildings scattered along the lakeshore. Several American flags wave in a light breeze. There are statues of soldiers along the driveway. His 9-year-old son, Quinn, bounds through the snow with two dogs, playing soldier. Down near the lakeshore, Anderson stoops to brush away the snow crusted on a slab of granite. It's engraved with the names Greg Rewer and Josh Hansen.
I lost two of my friends over there. I got together with my buddies and we made a nice little memorial for them. But
Anderson's mechanized infantry unit had a tough deployment in 2006 and 2007. They were on regular combat patrols. Two members died, several were wounded. Their tour in Iraq was extended from a year to 16 months. Anderson was awarded an Army Commendation Medal for pulling an injured soldier from a burning vehicle after a roadside bomb exploded. The medal hangs with others in a display case in the lodge at Grandview Resort. Anderson says the resort struggled while he was gone. The manager hired to run the business quit. For a while, his dad and brothers helped, but they all had their own businesses to run. Near the end of his 16 months in Iraq, Anderson's dad suffered a stroke, and so Jeff was sent home about 6 weeks early. He arrived home just as the tourism season was starting, faced with the task of rebuilding his struggling business.
So when I was gone, I lost a little bit over 100,000. It was tough, you know, just a lot of things that I would just do on a regular basis when I was here usually. I come back and I just find it just wasn't done. It was kind of nice, though, actually, to come back and jump right into the resort in a way because it kept my mind busy.
Anderson says being busy helps keep the nightmares at bay. They've come back this winter, nearly 3 years after he returned home. Anderson says he's still glad he was deployed, and he'd do it again, even though the experience changed him in many ways. On one hand, he's less patient with people, but he's also more relaxed about his business and his life.
I take more time for family, take more time for myself. Before I was deployed, I was always busy working, work. But now, after being over there and losing our friends and things, you know, you realize life is pretty short.
Many National Guard members found their perspective changed when they came home. A paycheck was less important. Relationships and a job with meaning mattered more. Ray Pizarro was deployed in the same unit as Jeff Anderson, the Morehead-based 136th Infantry. Pizarro says before he was deployed, he worked for a paycheck, but that just didn't make sense after his tour in Iraq.
It doesn't matter if you get paid in 2 weeks if you're not there to spend it, and you don't want your buddy to get hurt. So your focus is really different. It's a matter of survival. It's live or die.
Pizarro had a job waiting at Home Depot when he returned. He worked part-time at first, using vacation time accumulated while he was deployed. But some days he would call in sick from the parking lot because panic attacks kept him from getting out of the car. He struggled to deal with customer concerns that suddenly seemed trivial.
I lost a couple of friends over there. We had some serious injuries. I've seen some weird stuff. And so I know that I could have died as well. And the little things don't bother me anymore. And it's tough listening to little things like that bother other people.
Pizarro sought counseling, and he found medication that eased the panic attacks. He also realized he couldn't work at a job that wasn't a mission. So he found a job at the VA, helping veterans process claims.
It's given me a new mission to help other veterans that are hurting. It really replaces a lot of lostness, I guess. I don't know. Knowing that I can be there to help a veteran is a pretty amazing, powerful thing for me.
Having a mission, a meaningful job, can help veterans make the transition back to civilian life. Federal law requires companies to hold a job for deployed Guard members, and those positions can't be eliminated as part of a layoff. Many Minnesota businesses do much more. Dennis Brazer owns Central Boiler, a wood furnace manufacturer in Greenbush that employs 200 people. When one of his employees was deployed in 2006 and 2007, the company sent care packages, gave the employee his annual profit-sharing bonus, and helped his family. Brazer says losing an employee critical to the operation was a challenge, but the other employees pitched in.
You just don't go out on the street here and find people like him. There definitely was a loss to the system by not having him. And so when he left, everybody had to sort of make up for his lost input.
And Brazer says having everyone help support the deployed worker improved morale, and there was a support system in place when the employee returned. Getting back to work is an important part of the transition from soldier to civilian. Lieutenant Colonel Barb O'Reilly, Chief of Deployment Cycle Support for the Minnesota Guard, says while troops are deployed in a combat zone, their uniform and mission become their identity.
And if you come back and you're not able to transition into employment, where once again you have some identity, there are going to be challenges for those service members. And if they're not employed, the next thing that starts to happen is financial difficulties. Financial difficulties lead to relationship difficulties, which leads to other challenges.
O'Reilly says about a third of the troops returning this year will be unemployed. Some were unemployed before deployment. Others might be planning to go back to school. A study of troops who returned in 2007 found their unemployment rate was about twice the state average. Minnesota is recognized as a national leader in programs designed to support returning troops, but some don't take advantage of them. John Weisenberger is a veteran of the Vietnam War. He's now a veterans representative for the Department of Employment and Economic Development in western Minnesota. He says some veterans have to find new work when they return to civilian life. Maybe they can no longer work in a retail job because they don't have the patience with customers. Driving in traffic might bring flashbacks to the streets of Iraq for some veterans, and they need to find a job that doesn't involve travel. Weisenberger says his job is to help veterans find work or go back to school. But he says the best programs can only help those who ask for help.
There's a lot of this macho man o man o thing that I don't need help. I can deal with this on my own. As a Vietnam veteran who went through some stuff, I can testify to the fact that it took me 20 years to realize that I needed some help. I hope it doesn't take these troops that long.
The tough economy might make it more difficult for returning Guard members to find a new job, but Weisenberger says veterans return from deployment with new skills and new challenges. He says recognizing how they've changed is critical to a successful transition from soldier to civilian. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
You've just heard highlights from our series, The Red Bulls, Beyond Deployment. You can find the full series online at nprnewsq.org. NPR's Public Insight team has also created The Guide to Coming Home, an online collection of advice, tips, and resources from veterans and their families. That's online at nprnewsq.org.